After the flood, we have a list in Perek Yud of the children, descendants of Noach. Ve'ela told it b'nei Noach, shem cham v'yafet. So I hope that shem cham v'yafet has a ring to it, because almost every time, I would say every time that they're mentioned as those three, shem cham v'yafet, it always says shem cham v'yafet, which therefore leads you to a question. So why does it always say shem cham v'yafet? And the answer could be because they're born in that order. Okay, continue. But over here in Perek Yud, it then says b'nei yafet. So by saying b'nei yafet, what did it just now do? It just now went in inverse order. So just in case we don't realize the whole episode which took place when Noach proved himself to be an alcoholic, what happened then is Cham was the quote-unquote bad guy, and Shem, as far as we're concerned, is really the good guy. Yefet is the one who teams up with Shem, so he's the helper of the good guy. And most of Bereshit, and this is something we've seen before, most of Bereshit, the bad people in Bereshit are the ones coming from Cham, and the good people in Bereshit are the ones coming from Shem, even though we can always make some exceptions. But that's really basically how things play out. And it's going to play out as well, as we've seen in the past, in terms of where the Canaanites and so on all come from. It all comes down to a Shem versus Cham fight. So over here, when it tells us about the future, or the generations, the children, B'nai Yefet, so right away we should all notice that what it did by going to B'nai Yefet is it just now skipped Shem and Cham. So that would raise a question. And if we're doing it based upon who we think is best, then maybe we would have thought that Shem should have come first. If Shem was the oldest, then Shem should come first. But let's continue. B'nei Yefet, Gomer, Umagog, Umadai, and so V'Yavan, and so on and so forth. And that, I guess, is more important for Hanukkah. Now we're in Marcheshvan, so there are no holidays now anyway. But in Hanukkah, it's interesting to note that Yavan was not the enemy. Yavan is from Yefet, and Yefet is something where they work together. All right, right? Yefet and Shem work together, so that itself creates an interesting dynamic. So then what went wrong during the story of Hanukkah? And then after telling us about B'nai Yefet, it moves over to B'nai Cham, Pasuk Vav there. U'B'nai Cham, Kush u'Mitzrayim u'Fut u'Knan. So there, and Knan by this point had already been cursed, and because of the actions of Cham, presumably, depending how we understood that episode. But again, we move from Yefet to Cham. It then continues and tells us that Kush yoladet Nimrod, hu hachel yod gibor ba'aretz. He's the one who becomes someone who's powerful. And those of you may recall that powerful people were actually the problem that we had before the flood, which means now we have a remnant from the flood generation of somebody who's still exerting power. And as far as we're concerned, here's a lot of foreshadowing when we get to Esav, who will be described in very similar ways, and that's going to be, of course, disturbing when you have somebody from the Shem family, somebody from the Avram family, from the Yitzchak family, behaving very much like somebody from the Cham family, and genetics are interesting, how Yitzchak and Rivka can have a son who reminds them more of anybody other biblical character, reminds them of Nimrod. Continue. Vatihi reshit mamlachto bavel. So the beginning of his, so he exerts power, so now we're even using the word kingdom. His kingdom is going to be in a place called Bavel, and the particular location that we're told over here is a place called Eretz Shinar. Ulashem yulad gam hu, avi kol b'nei ever. Now that actually goes together, Shem and Ever. I don't know if you'd noticed this, but Shem and Ever are not father and son. There's a number of generations between Shem and Ever. And these are generally, as far as we're concerned, the good guys. I mean, this is like the great alibi in Sefer Bereishit. Whenever anyone's missing, where did he go? He went to learn in the yeshiva of Shem and Ever. Okay, so like, Yeah, I always say the mirror is the best alibi because, yeah, I learned in a yeshiva of 8,000 people. I was there. Yeah, I thought I saw you. But all you have to do to be noticed, actually, is to wear a blue shirt in the mirror, and then everyone will know exactly who you are. Anyway, Ulashem Yolad Gamhu Avi Kol B'nei Ever Achi Yefet HaGadol. So now that's a really strange formulation. It's a strange formulation, Achi Yefet HaGadol. So what exactly does that mean? So don't tell me what it means, because why should you know if no one else knows what it means? Rashi there says, Achi Yefet HaGadol, Eini Yodea, Im Yefet HaGadol, Im Shem. Because you have a dangling something over here, and therefore it's not clear who the older brother is. Is the older brother Shem, or is the older brother Yefet, which is exactly part of our problem? Rashi will then go on, and some of the commentaries will try to explain the verse and the phrase, and some of them will try to do math. Those of you who love math can read the rest of Rashi over here, because based upon some math, he tries to figure out who in fact is the older and who is the not older. Ramban, in the next half a source underneath Rashi, Vanira Elish Yehagadol Toar L'Shem. Ramban says, I think the oldest son is Shem, which of course then is a little bit of a problem. If the oldest is Shem, so then why wasn't Shem the one who was mentioned first? And I'm not going to get too much into this problem, just do one more. B'chor Shur in source 3, Achi Yefet HaGadol, L'fi she'b'chom mokom mona Shem t'chila v'kan mona derech toldotan, Yefet v'cham v'shem, magid lecha she'ze dafka Yefet hu HaGadol. So of course the B'chor says that Yefet is the oldest, and I'm going to tell you now, all this doesn't bother me. The reason I'm pointing this out is for a reason that you don't know, don't suspect, and it's something which troubles me, and I did not see anybody else troubled by this, so therefore, instead of going for therapy, I'm sharing this all with you, so now you could be troubled together with me, because, right, you know that joke? There was a Jewish couple, And the husband is laying in bed at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. He can't sleep, and his wife says, "Why can't you sleep?" He goes, "I owe Moshe, I owe him $50,000." He goes, "So why can't you sleep?" He goes, "I don't have the money." She goes, so she opens the window and she yells across the courtyard, "Moshe, Moshe, Moshe!" He opens the window. "What's the matter?" He goes, "Yes, he doesn't have the money," and closes the window. She goes, "No, he can't sleep. You can go to sleep." Right, that's the best thing. Push off your problems to somebody else. Correct? Don't hold it in. So
now that we're troubled by it.
No, you're not troubled yet. You don't know what the problem is yet. I thought you were already going to give me an answer. You're going to give me an answer. You don't know what the problem is.
I'm going to give you a speculation.
No.
Based on your learning.
No. No. Let me tell you.
No.
No. Let me tell you the problem, and then you'll give me the answer. Because then you can say, no matter what, say, yeah, I thought that was a problem. I noticed that. No. I already pointed that out. I'll tell you what bothers me. and I've been setting this up from the beginning. Who are the good people in this first whole third of Sefer Bereishit? So the good people are, which by the way may be incredibly superficial. Why? Because are there really people who are good or absolutely good? And that's the rabbinic approach. The rabbinic approach is that good people are very good, bad people are very bad, and bad people keep popping up. It's the same bad people, right? They just change the uniforms, but it's always the same bad people, and it's always really more or less the same good people. So if that wasn't clear what I just now said, we tend to take the good people and make them very good and therefore smooth away the problems, and we tend to make the bad people very bad and smooth away any possible good along the way. We see the Torah in a cartoon-like way where there are the good guys and the bad guys, and these things are absolute. One of the big arguments that takes place today, and this will depend in the modern Orthodox, in the religious Zionist, which has nothing to do with modern Orthodox, yes, no, maybe. So in the religious Zionist world, there's really two orbits where I guess there are two satellites, I'll put it that way. And one of them goes around, and I'm being also superficial now, would go around the Merkaz Arav yeshiva and approach, and the other one would probably go around the Gush approach. So what would be the difference in terms of reading Tanakh? This is what sometimes people call Tanakh begova einayim. Gova einayim means that you can see somebody on eye level, as it were, which means how do I look at the biblical characters? So, for example, in next week's parasha, Avraham and he's going to be told to leave wherever he leaves and go to the land of Canaan, and then there's a drought. So what does he do? So he goes down to Egypt, and then what happens? Then there are the questions about his wife. He goes off the wife. So now one approach would be to treat Avraham as the greatest spiritual hero and then try to figure out so exactly what happened over here, or you can do what the Ramban did. What did the Ramban say? He said, I think Avraham was wrong. So right there, you get, what do you mean, I think Avraham was wrong? So if the Ramban never wrote that, and if somebody today would write that, they would absolutely be attacked, because who are you to think that Avraham is wrong? So therefore, Gova Einayim would be, I look at the biblical characters as regular people. Now, if I look at it as regular human beings who have feelings and have thoughts and sometimes can make mistakes, so then there's probably a lot to learn from them. But on the other hand, you've maybe diminished some of their luster. On the other hand, those who look at them not at Gova Einayim, but as spiritual giants, so therefore, on the one hand, you have these great spiritual giants to look up to, but on the other hand, there's a, I would say, part of a human element which may be lost. So I want to now come back and ask again the question that I asked before. Who really is the good people from the first third of the book of Bereishit? And the answer I already told you. The answer is shame. Because we have our Noah, who presumably, by the way, is a good person, but he is a flawed good person, as the very Rashi tells us at the very beginning of the parsha. Some see him in a positive way, and some see him not such a positive way, and I believe we discussed that before. If not, then we have a topic for next year. But Noah, even as the good person, as the tzaddik, and I really don't believe Noah was a tzaddik, which is why you can now be mad at me. The Chumash says he's a tzaddik. How can I say he's not a tzaddik? Because I don't... Sorry, what? I actually never said that. The relative is by Dorotav, it's not by tzaddik. Right, right. The problem is that you all live in a post-Baal Shem Tovian world, which means is he's a tzaddik, is he like a chassidish rebbe? The word tzaddik in context, I don't believe it means righteous. I believe it means innocent. Innocent, it's judicial. Everyone was guilty and he was innocent. So just because you're innocent doesn't make you great. In fact, the big problem with Noah is trying to figure out what good... Right, but it doesn't... it's tamim bidorotav. Noach ish tzadik, and there's actually a little pause there in the trup, tamim haya bidorotav. So in his generation, he was perfect. What good did he ever do? I'm sorry for putting it like that. What... Good, good. I agree. Everyone else was guilty of rape and pillage and so on. So how many of you have never raped? No one raised their hands. You see that? No one raised. This is a frightening. So now that's not a very impressive. You put in your resume. There's a tough crowd. Yeah. If you could put in your resume, okay, all your greatness and say, oh, and by the way, he's never raped. Okay, that's wonderful. Now, by the way, if you were a producer in Hollywood and you can write has never been guilty of impropriety, if you never been charged. So okay, so here we go. So now guilt is a legal term, right? It's not a historical term, but we'll say it again. Noach was innocent. He was innocent because everyone else was guilty. So being the only non-rapist, I agree with you. Being a non-rapist in a society of rapists is pretty good, and that's really what Reish Lakish says in the Gemara. Judge somebody based upon their society, and peer pressure is something which is incredible. Nobody speak right now, but just for yourselves, so you can have something to say at the table Friday night. Think about the stupidest thing you've ever done in your life because of peer pressure. Right? And that's really the story of that generation. Everyone was thinking, okay, they're not thinking bad. No, but that's very humbling, because we've all have done things that now we look back, why would I do such a thing? And the answer is, of course, of peer pressure. You want the worst peer pressure in the Gemara? It's not really the worst, but I think it's the worst. It talks about going back to the Hanukkah period, it talks about the people who were embarrassed about being circumcised. They did some kind of self-procedure without anesthesia, which was called Moshech Bor Lasso, where visually they undid the circumcision. Okay? All the women are saying, okay, that's funny. But and the men are cringing. But That's because of peer pressure, because they're embarrassed because of the way that they look externally. So, Bob, probably it's worse than all. Just look at your old pictures. Some of you from the 60s or 70s or even 80s was not a good decade. I mean, 80s was not good for hair. I mean, and it was, okay. So I'm going to stop. But sometimes you just go back and you think about things you did for peer pressure. So Noah didn't do that. But then again, Noah didn't do very much good either, and that's really where, don't bother me, and that's really where the problem comes up. Now, when we continue from Noah, and the last time we saw him, he was drunk and naked on the floor. Oh, you're going to skip that over. The biographers tend to, no, stop. We're not talking about Noah. Noah is of no concern today. But it's his son, Shem, who's the one who's considered to be the good person. So can I finally tell you what troubles me? You've been kind enough listening to me ramble on. What troubles me is when I look at Perek Yud, it gave me the genealogy, right? That was source number one. It gave me the genealogy, and what was the sequence of the genealogies? It goes from, instead of Shem, Cham, v'Yafet, how did it go? From Yafet, Cham, and then Shem. Now, hold on to that. And then it ends, that source, source 1, Perek Yud, Pasuk Lamed Bet, ends, Eila Mishpachot B'nei Noach L'toldotam B'goyehim U'me'eila Nefredu Agayim Ba'aretz Achar HaMabul. So L'toldotam makes it sound like, okay, this is the proper sequence in terms of the ages. As I said, that you now you've seen the Rishonim debate that, and the debate is mainly over that verse where it describes him in terms of the Achi Yefet HaGadol, but that's not what bothered me. What happens immediately after chapter 10? Answer, chapter 11. Now, for some of you, chapter 11, I should have had a warning there, trigger warning for some of you, right? Okay, now we got to chapter 11. But what happens in chapter 11? The world becomes spiritually bankrupt. Well, or does it? So let's stop there. What is chapter 11 about? It's about building the tower. Okay? So now the tower comes up, and what happens immediately after the building of the tower? So that's, for those of you who don't remember, that's source number 4, right? Everyone's unified and so on, and they build the tower, and we're skipping all of that. And then after the whole story is told, and that whole story is only 9 verses, if you want, we'll read them. 9 verses, and what's the 10th verse there? Eila told a chain. Shem bin Meishan Avoyolid, and so on. And then it goes back and gives us the genealogy of Shem. So do you realize what just now happened? It went from Yefet to Cham to Shem, paused, told the story of the tower, and then it reverts back to telling us the story of Shem. Which means what I'm troubled with is, why is the story of the tower in the middle of the Shem genealogy? Is this a Shem story, or is this not a Shem story? That's really what bothers me. As I said, I haven't seen anybody put it like, because essentially what they do is they look at these as being two separate sections. You have the section over there of all 3 sons, and then we pause, we tell the story, and then we go on and we have the second part. And what's the purpose of the second part? It's in order to lead into a major character, which is really for, I don't want to ruin it for you for next week, but, or ruin the end of the parsha for you, but we're going to be introduced to somebody coming from that family, and who is that? That's Avram Avinu. Which means that we have the introduction of the Avram story taking place after the tower, or the dispersion, and that's something we need to think about as well. But really what I'm asking then is, so why is this tower story told in the middle of the Shem lineage, breaking it up? Yeah. So very, very good. So obviously there's some... I say obviously, it seems to suggest that there's something here about Avraham that we need to know, or something about the continuation of Shem that we need to know, because at face value, we would not have immediately have thought that this is really a Shem story. And I want to qualify why this is. Take a look again now, what we skipped.
Can I just say one thing?
You could say anything. I gave a class 7 years ago or so, and she still can't sleep after that class. No, I'll say it right now. And she's still haunted by it. It was, somebody told me it was the most haunting shiur they've ever heard in their lives, that shiur. Yes? That's true? Yes, it's true?
I was so angry.
You heard that? That one class turned her life upside down. So you're trying to wonder what could it possibly be that I said? We should sell that tape. We should not be giving this one for free. So let's read. We have to give out the medication at the beginning of class. We need the monitor to come in and give everybody's what's the ADD medication over here? The Ritalin, or at least for adults, the caffeine or something over here. Maybe the caffeine is bad. Makes it worse. How about orange juice with GOT? We'll get some from the shook over there. That should be good for everyone. You ready? Let's start reading source number 4, which comes in the middle of the two shame genealogy lists. Okay, that's what I wanted to point out. That's what troubles me. V'yihi kol ha'aretz safa echad u'dvarim achadim. And the whole world was of one language, and they spoke in a unified manner. Can we all admit that that sounds very good? It sounds like something which is good, which means unity is one of these things that we like. Matter of fact, I think you wouldn't have such a hard time going and looking at later prophets and Yeshayahu and so on and finding messianic prophecies about people speaking clearly in one language and so on and unity of the world, which means this is messianic times. That's essentially what we have in front of us. They traveled, well, what's Kedem here in this sense, other than my grandson's name? What is Kedem? They traveled from the east. And they found a valley. Now, this is one of these things, that was actually the starting point of that class, because if I were to ask you without thinking, so why did they build the tower? So you generally will have one of two interpretations. One is they were afraid there would be another flood, so therefore let's build a tower in order to be protected from the lowlands, from the flood, and so on, so now we're really going to be high. And the second reason is this more midrashic approach is that they wanted to go up into the heavens and wage war with God, which I do believe is true, but I believe maybe symbolically be true. What I mean by that is that I think Chazal are not telling you something which they intended for you to understand in a literal sense, but rather that there is something over here which is much more symbolic, which they want you to understand. But the thing which is troubling, if you want to build a tower and go up into the heavens, then you start to build up on a mountain and you don't start to build down in a valley. And more than that, if you build in a mountain, continuing on your point, so then you take rocks and you put one rock over another rock over another rock, and you build your thing up, which means this is a terribly ineffective and inappropriate way to build in the valley where you don't have the rocks and you're forced to use the sand and to make your own bricks or rocks, as it were, which means that this whole endeavor seems to be counterintuitive and counterproductive in terms of what we had assumed was the stated goal, namely to get up into the heavens. So let's read. And they settled in the valley. Okay? And please note that it's also a very positive sounding phrase. Ish el reyehu, right? That sounds good. There's actually a song which people sing, V'yishareyu v'emur chazak, or so on, which is actually talking about idolatry, although my son argued with me about that. But continue. Hava nil bana levenim v'nisrefa l'srefa. Let us go, and we're going to make bricks, and we're going to burn them, and so on, and make them in the right way. V'tihi lehem alevena la'oven v'chimar haya lehem l'chomer. And note, in this whole story, the only thing which really has detail is how they're making the bricks. There's nothing else of detail, which is why, again, the bricks are the important point. Vayomer havanu v'na lanu ir, let's build for us a city, umigdal, and a tower, v'rosho bashamayim, and its top will reach towards the heavens, which really means let's make it very tall. V'nasa lanu shame, and we will make for ourselves. Now, what does a shame mean? So I think that's also part of the problem here, because it sounds like self-aggrandizement, we're going to make ourselves very popular, and so on. I don't think that that's what shame means. Pen nafots al pnei kol aretz, lest we be spread out among the whole world. Now that's incredibly strange, because it's like they have inside information what God is going to do to them when he ends up not being happy with what they've done. Then he goes and he spreads them out. So what is really this whole thing about? So you can say, well, the whole thing is about, again, if you are particularly cynical, you can say this is just a myth in order to say how the people spread out. You can say for that point it's a myth in terms of how different languages were introduced. Let's continue. Ve'yered Hashem l'ra'ot et ir ve'et hamigdal. And God came down and saw both the city and the tower, asher banu b'nei Adam, which the people had built. Ve'yomer Hashem, and God says, hin am echad usfa echad, they're one nation and they speak one language, l'kulam v'zeh chilum lasot, and I think that's how it should be read. The Al-Sheikh reads it that way with a question mark, and this is what they do? And the Al-Sheikh sees this as a window of opportunity to have had a messianic age, which means the unity and so on should have brought something which was far greater. And this is what they do. Va'ata lo yivatzer mehem kol asher yazumu lasot, which they plot. Yazumu is a very strong word. God is going to frustrate their plan. Havaner dov nivlosh sham svatam. God is going to confuse their language. Asher lo yishma'u ish svat re'ehu, and therefore they were not going to understand the language of their colleagues. Va'yafetz Hashem otam misham al pnei kol ha'aretz, and then they were spread out in the whole entire world. Va'yachadlu levnot ha'ir, and they stopped to build the city. Al ken kor shma Bavel, and that's why it's called Bavel. Kisham balal Hashem svat kol ha'aretz, and there God confused or combined the languages, as it were. Umisham hifitzam Hashem al pnei kol ha'aretz, and God spread them out all over the world. Now, what I want you to note over here, and it's really easy to know what I want you to note because I always put it in bold. So, what is it that I mean? This is like Torah by numbers almost. So what is it that I want you to denote? I want you to note that the name of God being used over here is the Yudke Vavke, which is the Shem of Rachamim, which really is perhaps counterintuitive because, again, if God comes and judges and he looks, and there, those actually learned from this, that a judge should come and see the situation, and God comes down and looks. But it's really interesting because if God is in his judge robes right now, then the name that should have been used should have been Elohim. So that's the thing which is interesting in this whole section. It seems to be, and I want to say this clearly, it seems to be that there really is something positive taking place, but the positive thing which is taking place is being misdirected or misused, and there's a problem with it, which means, let me put it a little differently. Based on face value over here, it's very difficult for me to say, so what was the sin of this generation? Because I don't see a sin over here. I see a people say, let's gather together and let's go and let's build something unified. And again, we don't know what that shame means yet. And I know as well as you do, because I also went to kindergarten. So I know about the whole background of the story, and they took swords, they wanted to go up to heaven and wage war against God, which is also very interesting. It means that you believe that God exists, but you're mad at God. Again, just think for a second what Chazal are telling us. If you want to climb to heavens and wage war against God, so you know there's a God, you know God's in heaven, but what is it? You don't like that God very much. So then the question comes, why don't you like that God very much? Which brings us again back to the introduction or the background of the story, and the background of the story should be really the flood, which brings us back to this point of, okay, if there was a flood, maybe they're afraid there's going to be another flood. There's also a great rabbinic comment which Rashi picks up on, is that the scientists among them said, it seems to be that every 1,600 and something years, there's a flood, so we have to be careful in preparation for the next one, because that's what scientists do. They observe phenomena. So rather than say that perhaps that God micromanaged and caused this to happen, rather that maybe this was a natural phenomena, and therefore we need to build a high place, which again is a little difficult, so why not just go and live in high places? Because again, if you travel around Israel, you will notice a difference, especially in places where you have both Jewish populations and you have Arab populations. The Jews tend to live up on the higher ground, and the Arabs tend to go and to live in the valleys as well. And it's really interesting over here why they chose specifically to live in the valley, or what advantages are to the valley, or is there a statement involved in the valley? Now, the outrageous thing that I had said in the past, so I'll say it now so that you can at least know it, and then we'll move on, is that there are a number of rabbinic suggestions which all lead to the same point. And that is that after the flood, everything was gone. Everything was destroyed. All the people died, all the vegetation was gone, and everything. And where did everything go to? It goes down and sinks to the lowest possible place, which means that the raw materials they were using to build these bricks was made out of the remains of the people who were killed during the flood. Which means they're building a monument. And I want to now stress the word monument, because the word shame, as far as I can tell, is really connected to source number 7. Source number 7 is a verse in Yeshayahu, which some of you will recognize. Anybody recognize the phrase Yad Vashem? So why is it called, what does Yad Vashem mean over here? What is a Yad and what is a Shem? So you're going to say, oh, it's a hand and a name. No, that's not what, does a Yad Vashem mean? A monument and a remembrance, in the sense is that that's to remember what has happened. When they say Naselanu Shem, I believe this is the Shem over here. They want to build a monument to all of the dead, and they're building a monument out of the dead. And what's so disturbing and so frightening about this is like somebody saying, let's go to Treblinka and use the remains which are there to build our monument. Now, you only could possibly do that if you're filled with a great deal of anger. Which means this is the anger at God, which the rabbis then clean up a little bit and turn it into, oh, let's take swords and go and fight against God. So you know that God exists, but you're mad at him. So these are people who are incredibly mad at God. Now, I want to try to make this a little bit stronger. Now, if you look at source 5 and 6, both of them are commenting on the phrase Ish El Reyehu, which again is a nice phrase. V'ahavta l'reyacha kamocha. Ish el re'ehu is a nice term. A re'ah is a friend. The word tru'ah, tru'at melech bo, is friendship that we have with the king, with God. Source 5 is a midrash. It says, v'yamu ish el re'ehu, kush amar l'nimrod. And that's beautiful because this is father and son. It's nice for them to get together and do some activities together. Source number 6 says, Isha Reyehu, mi amar lami, amar av barachya, Mitzrayim amar lekush. And then you have two brothers working together, which is, again, a wonderful thing for brothers to work together, which is so much of the theme of Sefer Bereishit. They don't work together. So according to this midrash, where's the first time we find brothers working together? Those who say, let's go and build our tower. Now, the background that we already saw when we noticed the genealogy was that the first kingdom is run by Nimrod. So, and where does it take place? By Bavel and by Shinar. And this place is Bavel, which means that we may very well have had already a description of what's happening over here before it happened, unless, and I'll admit this as a possibility, the whole idea of the kingdom of Nimrod is really after this whole story. Which means the question comes up, how do we take that section of Nimrod being the king, the first person having a kingdom, and the place is Bavel together with the Tower of Bavel? Are these two independent stories, or is this really one story? So now, let's work a little bit harder. What I just now did with both of these midrashim is point out that there is reason, there is evidence to suggest that this is a Cham story. It is not a Shem story. This is the Cham father and son, or sons of this. They're the ones who make this kingdom. They're the ones who are doing this. But what's the problem with saying that? How did the story begin in source number 4? V'yikola aretz safa achad. Everybody's there. So now everybody's there, and the most powerful is the one who becomes the leader, and there's leadership, but you have the followers, and the followers may very well have been the ones who we would not have wanted to follow such a person, and who's that going to be? That's going to be the Semites, right? The children of Shem are the ones who perhaps are there as well. And now I'll point out again that this whole story is told within the Shem story, so maybe it's shameful, I'm sorry for saying that, it's shameful when the Shem people are following the Cham people in creating such a thing. But we need a little bit more perspective and a little bit more background. So, what's the introduction to this story? So for us, you know, it really, again, goes back to the flood. So what is the flood? The flood is a time that you have all this rain and all of this destruction and all of this death. And all that I've pointed out so far is that literally this tower may have been building up a memorial for all those people that died. Again, as disturbing as that may be, but if you look, just for example, at the Radak in source number 8, look at the end of that first paragraph in Pasuk Bet. He writes, why is it called Shinar, Eretz Shinar? Lafisha meite me hamabul nin arud sham lafisha haye bika. that all of the dead from the Mabul drained out to that lowest place, and that's why it's called Shinar. Shinar is the drain where everything drained to. So I said that's there. But again, this is not just the Radak. The Radak's quoting the Gemara over here. So let me pause for a second and give a little bit more background, and then maybe we can understand this a little bit better. What was the problem with the flood? The problem, which means, why did God bring the flood? God brought the flood because we had a generation where might made right, where the powerful men, again, it goes back to what I said before. This is the Me Too generation, except there was no Me Too, and there's no hashtags, and there was no op-eds, and there was nobody to complain to. It was powerful people taking advantage of other people. Now, the only problem I have with that at face value is because it says the powerful men, they took the woman, they took whoever they wanted to. So if that's the case, you should just kill the powerful men. Why are you getting rid of the women as well? What did they do wrong? So apparently what we have is a total breakdown of any type of morality in this generation where everybody takes advantage of anybody that they can, which means it's a generation of anarchy. There is no leadership. There is no social contract. Everybody takes anything they can from anybody else. That was the rules. And that's a generation full of Hamas, which means it could be the men take the women, but the women take the women go and they steal objects. And meaning everybody takes anything which they can. So you have over here a total breakdown, which means, in a sense, if you want to go look at your Ten Commandments, so which one of the Ten Commandments are they breaking, and what's the answer going to be? Okay, there you go, all of them. So what you have over here is a total breakdown of society with everybody being abusive in any way that they can. So essentially, what is the motto of the generation? Get away with whatever you can. Which means, where is there essentially no respect? There's no respect for other people. There's no sense of seeing other people as it's Tselem Elokim. There's no respect of other people's property or other people's person. You just do whatever you can. So, what am I now really saying? I'm trying to claim that this generation of unity is a response to the generation of havoc. There's no rules, there's no leadership, there's no boundaries. Over here, let's create a city, let's create Ish L'Re'ehu, let's create something together. But there may have been something else that they were doing that also that we don't recognize, which will only make sense to those of us who live, and it still is, grew up and experienced a post-Holocaust generation. There's something else over here that perhaps we need to understand, which they were doing. What we're told about the tower were a couple of things. One thing we told, okay, you can make the whole thing with the bricks, but again, where did they get to? They got to a valley. And that valley is demarcated, and it's limited geographically. Which means there are going to be mountains at some point on various sides. They all decided to live in one limited geographic way. And it very well could also be, and again, this is picked up by some, that you build the big tower in order to create the center of where they are, and this is where we live. We're not going to live anyplace else. We all want to live right here in this place, and that also raises the question, so what else are they trying to say? If you look at the Ramban, in source number 9, towards the end of the first paragraph, he writes, O Shema Yechoshim Shelo Yifru V'Shelo Yirbu, that one of the thoughts that they have is that they are not going to bring children into the world. Because why bring children into a world which is so cruel? Why bring children into a world where there's going to be death? And why bring children into the world? See, what is really going on over here? And this is going to help us a great deal to understand this parsha and then future parshiot as well, which I'm going to give you little hints along the way now. They may have believed in God. And why would I say they believed in God? Even though God is completely absent from the whole narrative till God comes down and looks at what they're doing, sees the unity, sees everything. But they may have believed in God, but they just thought that God was absolutely cruel and that God was something which is evil, and God does terrible things to them, which means it could have been that they only sense God in terms of a strict Midat Hadin. By the way, one of the challenges you have, which we can do a little bit, but we're going to run out of time, and that is to notice the names of God throughout this week's parsha. even the end of last week, which is the introduction running through this week, and notice in the whole flood story when it says Yudke Vavke and when it says Elohim, because they're both used in the story. And there's actually some serious challenges to the documentary hypothesis here as well, the way that the two names are actually fused together in certain sections. The initial analysis, look at source number 10, V'yihi ki hachel ha'adam l'rov al p'nei adam. So notice that what is the pru uravu, that they began to multiply. And what happens then? Then there's children, there are girls, and so on. V'yu b'nei Elohim et b'nota adam, the powerful take whoever they want. Ki tovot heina, because they're good looking, they take because they can. V'yichulam nashim mikol asher b'charu, they took whatever they wanted. Again, that's the first description over here of this moral breakdown, is the powerful men taking whatever they want to take. Notice the name of God used now, V'yomer Hashem. Lo yadun ruchi. It's very interesting because it talks about what you could call a midat hadin, but nonetheless it was yudke vavke. Ba'adan lalam b'shagam hu basar, and so on and so forth, and nefilim, pasuk, hey vayar Hashem, ki rabba ra'a ha'adam ba'aretz. Vayomer Hashem emche et ha'adam. So it's interesting that it's God's sense of compassion that destroys this generation. Why? This isn't judgment, because there's no compassion. It's God's sense of compassion that is the motivation, as it were, for this destruction. Does that make any sense? Okay, I have to say this in English now. As a parent, there are some times that what we do for or to our children are perceived as being strict, and sometimes it's perceived as being kind. Good? Love. But we all know that very often when we're strict, what's motivating us is actually our kindness. Because, you know, the kid who you say, go to sleep and brush your teeth, and they say, well, I'd rather just watch television and eat candy. And now the parent says, you know what, that's great. You know, why don't you just wash it down with a beer, you know, while you're at it. So the parent who's completely kind in behavior is actually being quite cruel. And the parent who's being strict is actually being quite kind. So we just have to make a distinction between two things. One point is motivation, and the other point is action. Which means God's treatment of this generation is motivated by absolute concern for kindness and benevolence, because there's no kindness and benevolence over here. These people have created a social structure whereby everybody is doing violence. So if everyone's doing violence and God is a God of benevolence, so God's sense of benevolence says this cannot continue because of God's kindness. So now in terms of the perception on our part and the action over here which takes place, so that's the continue of the text over here. And then again, that ends up, I'm still in source 10, Pasuched, V'noach matzachein be'enei Hashem. But then, Ela told Noach, and so on, Noach shidoratav, et Elohim hitalek Noach. Okay, that's interesting because it just switched to Elohim. But Tetshichet Aretz Lefnei Elohim, V'yirar Elohim et Aretz, and so on. And it's Elohim who comes and gives the judgment, because that's God as judge. So you do have a back and forth, and it continues in source 11. Again, notice the back and forth that takes place in the different names, and I'm not going to work all of this out for you right now, but it doesn't end with God as the judge. It then switches over as Yudke Vavke again, which essentially is going to be, and to bring the animals, which will be used for the korbanot afterwards, which is going to be healing the relationship with God, and so on. And it's not a sense of midat hadin. So I'm saying all that comes there in the background. While in this section, it never mentioned Elohim. It was always Yudke Vavke. So I want to go back and say this again now. Their sense of God was a God who comes and is full of destruction. It's like they see God as this thing that creates havoc and not as a God who came, maybe as we should look at it. Everyone was so spiritually impure, you needed this big mikveh to come over here and to purify the world, as it were, to create a reset, to create again benevolence. So the last possible understanding they have of God is a God who's benevolent. So let's pause there for a second. In source number 12, Vayizkor Elokim et Noach, so that also, once again, should be counterintuitive, because it should have been Hashem, because that's kindness. No. Once the judgment has taken place, and there's no more evil in the world, God as judge can now remember Noach, and the world can now continue based upon fairness and having deserving for it to continue. So it's Vayizkor Elokim et Noach. That means they deserve it. And God now takes away the water because this is judgment, because there's no more evil which remains. And then it says, Vaydeber Elokim al Noach lemor, go tse min ateva. Pasuk Yud Zayin, kolachaya, right, take the animals off. Vishurtsu ba'aretz uparu varu al aretz. And you should spread out the land and you should have children. And then it goes on to say, Vayivin Noach Mizbeach LaHashem. This is consistent every time in the Torah we have a korban being brought. It's always Yudke Vavke. It's never that you're bribing the judge. It's always getting close to the benevolent God who's transcendent. Vayikach, and he brings all the behemot taharot. Vayar Hashem et Reach Nichoach, Vayamar Hashem, Eldibo Lo Siva Kalel Odat Adama, and so on. Continue to source 13, which is the next parak. V'yivarech Elokim et Noach b'nav v'yomer lehem pru uvu meluat ha'aretz. Have many children, and what does meluat ha'aretz mean? Spread out. Pasuk zayin va'atem pru urbu shirtzu ba'aretz urvu ba. It's interesting. God has to keep on saying this, and now the. And now the question is, why does this have to be, keep on saying it? So now I want to go back to the point which the Ramban cites, and that is that maybe that's not what they wanted. See, the geographic these things go together. There are two things that were linked. What was linked? One was having children, and the other is spread out. They don't want to spread out because they want to live in one self-contained place. So now what's the inference? The inference is they don't want to have children either, which now leads me back to the same point. So why would not this generation want to have children? Because they're a post-Holocaust generation who's waiting for the next one to come, and they're saying, why bring children? It's such a cruel world. Why? Which means they don't identify God as something that is benevolent, and they don't develop within themselves necessarily this sense of benevolence either. So therefore, what we have now is a generation who is strict, but realize the strictness over here is a response to the lawlessness that had existed in that previous generation. The previous generation, it's every man for themselves, and now they need to make it, we're going to be unified. Now, of course, there's a downside to unity. And what's the downside of unity? The downside of unity is what happens to the other voices within this, which means how do you keep unity when you have dissidents? And the answer is you get rid of those dissidents. So, and just again, for the sake of completeness, you can source 14 as well, goes back to the very beginning. The introduction of man was as well, Peruavu, Umelua to Aretz Vikivshua. So from the very beginning, God is telling us, have children, spread out. This is the world for you to fill up. And now you have this generation who are rejecting God as a parent, and they don't want to be parents. Do you know that? They reject God as a parent. They don't want to be parents themselves. They're seeing God as something which is only strict and therefore a world which is strict. And within all of this, somebody emerged. And the person who emerged is, of course, Avram Avinu. And those of you who don't recall or don't remember or don't imagine such a thing, according to the Seder Olam, Avraham was a young man there. Incidentally, it wasn't just Avraham who was there according to the Seder Olam. According to the Seder Olam, Noach was still there. Noach dies 10 years after the dispersion. Noach is there. Shem is there. Aver is there. Now that's really interesting because always look at Shem and Aver as being this is the great yeshiva. So what went wrong with Shem and Aver? See, that's part of what I want. What went wrong with Noach? So apparently, the power of a Nimrod over here, with all the others, creates a situation where all the voices are silenced. And why are they silenced? They're silenced because, well, sometimes when you have your echo chamber, nobody can possibly speak out against it. And if you speak out against it, then you get attacked. So you have over here a generation which creates unity, but the unity is achieved by silencing anybody else who will speak. So therefore Noach we're not surprised with, because Noach is always quiet. Noach was never the one who reaches out to others. Noach was always the one whose greatness was that he didn't do bad, but he doesn't do good either, and that's exactly the problem over here, which means that even in the last scene that Noach is implied, or we can infer that he's there, we don't hear anything about Noach. The second, perhaps, but he's the patriarch, and maybe he has an ability to speak, and we don't know the answer to that. He doesn't speak. And Shem and Ever and others who perhaps we would expect something, he doesn't do anything. Now, according to the Midrashim, and I'm just putting a little bit together, there is somebody who speaks, but that's something that we all know about, which is we're not thinking sometimes. Look at source number 15 again. Levinim, right? This is how they made the rocks. She'ein avanim bebavel, because they didn't have the big rocks over there. Again, this is, I want to go even further. It's in the valley. Shehi bik'ah. That's exactly the problem. They went into the valley. They didn't go to the place, and that's why they needed to make the bricks themselves. V'nisrifalas reifa, kachol simu levinim shakorim, whatever belaz, tiles, I think it is. I'm making that up. That's right. We brought you from France. What does that say? It's in French. What is the word?
I don't know.
So I'm making it up that it's tiles.
Okay,
and it says then parentheses Ra'afim in 15, Sofimotan Bikivshan. And how do you make this? You need a furnace. So what Rashi is pointing out, and this just, we sort of like skip over this, is that there's a furnace here. Why is there a furnace? Because it just now described how you made the bricks. And how do you make the bricks? What do the Chumash say? They made a sreifa. So where do they make the sreifa? They had a furnace. So in this furnace, they're making the bricks. It's part of the factory to make the bricks, and you have the furnace over there. And again, the horrific image, you're taking the human remains, you're mixing it up, you're making this, you have a furnace now as well. It just got worse even now?
Yeah.
I'll give you nightmares also? Okay. Now you know why she was mad at me for the last number of years? I told you didn't think of everything, and you still need me. So, and now all the saying is, just keep in mind, because there's somebody else that we know once got thrown into a furnace. And what you never thought about is, so where was that furnace he was thrown into? Why was there a furnace there? It just happened to be that there was a furnace? No. Is that Avraham's sedition, Avraham's being a dissident, his going against what's Avram HaIvri, going against what everyone else believes, there's a context to it. And the context was always staring at us, and we never paid attention to it. Because the context, Avram got into trouble with who? With Nimrod. Oh, where did Nimrod live? Like, where did Nimrod live? In Bavel. So look now at source number 16. Vayomer lav ani Hashem asher hotzeticha mi'ur kasdin. What does the word ur mean? Furnace. Look at the Targum Yonatan underneath it. I'm the one who took you out of the fire. I'm the one who saved you from the furnace. Which means that Avram Avinu is the one who was in the furnace, thrown in the furnace, and again, the only thing we never paid attention to is which furnace was it? What was the furnace when they were building the tower? Because Avram is the only voice which is rebelling, which means we have a wonderful thing here. What is the wonderful thing? Unity. But what's the downside of the unity? How do you create or do you sustain the unity? That if anyone opens their mouth and argues with you, you throw them into a furnace, which means it could be that the generation of the flood is a generation. If I call it individualism, that's just not true. It's not individualism. What is it? It's anarchy, where everyone does whatever they want to do, which more often there was a price to it, and that was the victim who they just now victimized. So now the response to this is like this totalitarian regime, which is going to force rules. There is no individual anymore. There is no individualism anymore. And if you open your mouth, then you're going to be attacked. Now, the one who opens his mouth, and now we can understand something much deeper. Who opens his mouth? Avraham. And what is he saying to them? There is a God. And they may not debate that point. They just don't like that God. And what does Avraham say about this God? What is the God that Avraham finds? He is a God of chesed. He's a God of kindness. He's a God of decency. He's a God who's benevolent. And they say that is the most obscene thing a person can possibly say. How can you say after this flood and all these people were killed that God has any benevolence? And of course, what is the response? Getting rid of wicked people is not itself wicked. Getting rid of wicked people who have no respect for individuals, getting rid of the rapists and so on and so forth, where the whole society had broken down, is a function actually of kindness. And that's why the name Yudke Vavke was there from the very beginning within that story. And now keeping this in mind, again, what were the points? The points were, here's a generation that can't accept God as being kind. Now, which aspect of God came down and took a look to see what they're doing? It was Yudke Vavke. It was that God who's benevolent. Now, what does God do who's benevolent, who sees these people are unified, which is a wonderful thing, but for the wrong reasons? So what does God do? He doesn't kill them. He doesn't make another flood. He spreads them out in order for them to find their individuality and to find this other voice that needs to be found, because they can't accept the voice of Avraham. Their unity has become something which is negative, which means, unfortunately, it's just not the right time for unity. Because if the unity that you have is in an oppressive regime, that's not the unity which God is looking for. If it's a unity which creates kindness, if it's a unity that creates decency, that's a whole different type of unity. So now you had a generation that was malevolent. You have a society which does not want to have children. You have a society that does not want to spread out. So the response is, you're going to spread out, you're going to have children, and they're building their bricks. And I just want to keep all of that in mind when we turn over the page and we continue our Avraham story. One is, if you need someone else to have said this, source number 19 talks about Nimrod throwing Avraham into the furnace. You did not need that for me because he already knew that, but there you have it on a piece of paper. It's also in Medrash Rabbah. Source number 20 is the Netziv, who points out, although he did not work anywhere nearly as hard as I worked, but he points out and he writes, V'nira dekan mirumaz kabbalat chazal dipilo Avraham avinu l'kiv shona esh. When the whole thing talks about building making the bricks and having the fire, he says, I think this is where the rabbis got their sense that Avraham was thrown into the furnace. And as I said, I worked a little bit harder, but the Netziv just threw it out. But now we can maybe appreciate two more things. In source 21, when Avraham and God finally get to speaking, V'yom Hashem al Avraham, lech lecha me'artzecha. You still have to come next week, by the way. When you leave, lech lecha me'artzecha, me'latochem beit avicha, eretz hashareka, v'eschad l'goy gadol, right, and making a great nation. So again, there is this ethic which comes again and again whenever God talks to Avraham about having children. Now realize the irony. Avraham wants to have children, and he's the one who wants, but he can't, and the others don't want, which is also, I think, a really interesting background. But the other thing, which now will take a completely different complexion than you ever imagined it before, is source 22. V'ashem amar el Avraham acharei pared milot me'imo sanai necho re'ei min ha'makom ashat ha'sham tzfona v'negma v'kedva v'yema. Again, spreading out into all directions. That's the biblical blessing from the very beginning. Spread out, but what was the other element? Not just spread out, also have children. Okay, spread out all over and your descendants will have it. And I'll make your descendants like the afar ha'aretz. And just think about how afar was used in the previous section as a symbol of death. And now with Avraham, afar gets turned around and becomes the symbol of life. And if anyone would have understood this, it's Avraham who was thrown into the fire to get together with those, you know, the sand in order to make the bricks. And now there's this complete turnaround over here. And I'm just saying is that we normally just start next week's parasha. We disassociate it from this whole background. We don't see Avraham as being a survivor from that whole generation of the tower. And we just see it as an independent story. When you realize the elements in that story, it's Avraham's kindness. It's his benevolence. It's the opposite of that generation. He rebels against that generation. Avram wants to spread decency throughout the world. And the only thing that I can say is that thank God Avraham wins, and this this idea, not to say what we live up to it, but the idea of love, the idea of compassion, the idea of peace, all of these things as ideals. The idea that humanity should be working together. Again, we fail miserably implementing it. But Avram changed the course of history from people being anti-kindness, anti-decency, and turning a world into a world where I would say a good portion of the world, if not all of them today, are descendants or spiritual descendants or physical descendants of Avraham, and they want peace in the world. They want there to be decency. They haven't figured out how to get there, but when we do figure that out, then we're going to go back to a sense of unity where once again the entire world will be able to speak one language, and that language will be the language of Avraham Avinu.